John Jumper said on Friday that he is joining Anthropic, and Demis Hassabis posted a public send-off from Google DeepMind. The Bloomberg item circulating through Reddit adds the public shorthand. Jumper is a 2024 Nobel laureate and the AlphaFold lead. So the immediate fact is simple enough. A scientist whose name is tied to one of DeepMind's most successful scientific systems is moving to a rival lab. The harder question is what follows from that without overreading it. One person moving labs doesn't prove that Google DeepMind is broken. It doesn't prove Anthropic has suddenly become the AI for science lab, but it does put a specific kind of expertise in motion. Not just model training, not just chat products, but the practice of turning machine learning into scientific infrastructure. Start with the method, and the departure makes more sense.
The way I'd separate it is this: the public move is personnel, but the operator question is method transfer. AlphaFold wasn't famous because it had a nice demo. It was famous because the output could be tested against a scientific task people already cared about. If Anthropic is hiring Jumper, I care less about whether he brings one finished system with him. He doesn't. I care about the habits he brings, how to pick a scientific target, how to build evaluation around it, and how to know when a model result has crossed from impressive to useful. That kind of taste is hard to put in a README.
And the timing changes the texture, because Noam Shazir's move from Google to OpenAI was already in the background this week. Construct only needs that as context, not as a second lead. Two symbolic departures in a few days invite a pattern, but the sources we have don't tell us why either person moved. So I would keep the public claim narrow. Google DeepMind has now watched two highly visible researchers leave for direct competitors. Anthropic gets someone whose public reputation is tied to scientific modeling. OpenAI gets someone tied to Transformer-era architecture. If you're watching labs as an operator, you don't need to invent private motives to notice that the talent market is now about proven taste as much as raw model scale.
Yes, and taste is something procurement teams can't buy directly. You can rent GPUs by an API contract and hire a lot of capable people and still not know which experimental loop is worth trusting. I keep coming back to DeepMind's own problem here. A lab can lose a person and keep the method, or it can learn that too much of the method lived in the person. We don't know which one applies, but that's the institutional test after a departure like this. Does the next scientific system still ship out of the organization, or did the judgment that made AlphaFold work leave with the team members who carried it?
That also keeps us from turning Anthropic into a blank symbol. The Helen Toner item in today's pool talks about Anthropic strategy and risk posture, and the Anthropic access story has been moving all week. But today, I don't think the best use of Anthropic is another access politics chapter. We did that. Braid did that yesterday. Here, the specific new fact is that Anthropic is adding someone from the scientific modeling side of DeepMind. If their public identity has been safety, constitutional training, and enterprise-grade assistance, Jumper gives people a reason to ask whether Anthropic wants a stronger scientific bench. That's an inference, not a statement from the company, but it's a fair question to ask after the move.
And for Google, I wouldn't start with, "Are they losing?" I would ask, what parts of their advantage are institutional and what parts are concentrated in a few people? I know that sounds abstract, but it gets practical fast. If your advantage is institutional, you can show it with the next artifact. Another model, another scientific benchmark, or another product that turns research into a working system. If your advantage is concentrated in a few people, the org chart starts to matter more than the roadmap. That's why this story deserves the lead without needing a crisis narrative wrapped around it.
OpenAI published a 51-second NTT data codex clip on Friday claiming more than 10,000 active users and a technical analysis workflow compressed from 2 days to 30 minutes. That needs care. It's an OpenAI customer clip, so those are OpenAI's claims in a marketing artifact. But the clip pairs oddly well with Guinness Chen's post about codex handoff between local and remote work. The adoption number is the obvious headline. The handoff detail is more revealing for builders because it treats a coding agent session as something that can move across hosts.
That's the implementation detail I care about. A coding agent stops being a chat box when the session has location. It might run on a local machine. It might run in a remote sandbox, a cloud runner, or a CI-attached environment. Once the session can move, you have to preserve more than the prompt. You need the repo state, the command history, the file changes, the credential boundary, and the post-handoff permission model. If the enterprise clip says Codex is entering normal company workflow, the handoff post says what has to exist underneath for that workflow not to become a mess.
That changes the meaning of trust. In a demo, you can ask, did the diff work? In an enterprise workflow, you ask who approved the task and what data entered the session. You also ask which machine ran the commands and whether the next person can inspect the record. The NTT data claim is a productivity claim. A 2-day technical analysis becoming a half-hour task is exactly the kind of number that will make executives lean forward. Halyk, if you were the operator receiving that pitch, where would you press first?
I would ask for the denominator. How many tasks were tried? Which tasks got counted? Was the 30-minute version accepted as is, or did another human spend an afternoon checking it? And did Codex save time because it reasoned better or because the company had already prepared the environment so the agent could act? That last one matters. A lot of agent DMOS are secretly environment DMOS. The model looks magical because the repo is available, the tests run, the permissions are set, and the task is scoped. That doesn't make the result fake. It means the product includes the operating surface around the model.
Jason Liu's item in the same cluster points toward local models, and Changpeng's post points toward budget management use. I wouldn't overbuild those two into a single product thesis, but they make the Codex story feel less like one vendor's clip and more like a larger routing problem. Where should the agent run? Which model should it use for this step? When does the session need to come home to the developer's machine? When does it belong in a remote executor with better isolation? The moment you ask those questions, Codex adoption becomes infrastructure design.
And infrastructure design means the administrative parts become user-facing. Identity decides who can start the session. Logs decide who can audit it. Permissions decide what the agent can touch. Rollback and artifact storage decide whether the team can recover when the handoff goes wrong. If a session moves from my laptop to a remote host and back, I need to know which fax moved with it and which one stayed behind. Otherwise, the handoff becomes a copy-paste with more confidence attached. That's exactly where enterprises get nervous, and they aren't wrong to be nervous.
The FT item on Hacker News says companies are reining in AI usage as costs strain budgets. We don't have the full FT article here, so I'm not going to add detail beyond that summary. But the broad pressure is familiar. Companies try the tools, usage grows, and then someone has to explain the bill. Ethan Mollick's counterpoint is useful because it complicates the reflex to route everything to the cheapest acceptable model. His point is that companies may underestimate the value of stronger models when cheaper ones satisfy visible key performance indicators.
That's exactly the operator trap. You pick a cheaper model because the dashboard says task completion stayed flat. Then 3 months later, you realize the harder cases were silently downgraded. The analysis got worse, human review took longer, escalations increased, the writing became less useful, or decisions slowed down. The bill went down, but the work moved somewhere else. Sometimes that's the right trade. Sometimes it's just accounting with latency hidden in another team.
The local El Lama item about open model economics and the semi-analysis item about data center capacity narratives both sit behind this same budget conversation. But I'll keep the segment grounded. Recent episodes already spent time on compute economics. Friday's fresher question is architectural. Can your system change its mind about intelligence level? If the answer is yes, then cost pressure doesn't force one permanent downgrade. It forces measurement. Which tasks need the strongest model? Which tasks can use an open weight model locally? Which tasks need a human before a cheaper answer leaves the system?
Exactly. The design I would want is less choose a model and more choose a policy for choosing. You need traces that say why this task used the expensive model. You need evals that catch when the cheap route misses something valuable. You need enough abstraction that swapping providers doesn't become a 6-week migration. And you need to admit that cheaper isn't the same as more efficient. Efficient means the whole job got done with less waste. Cheaper can mean the invoice got prettier while the review queue got worse.
That pulls the Codex segment back in without forcing it. If a coding agent session can move across machines, the model choice probably moves too. Local for privacy or speed. Remote for stronger reasoning. Open weight for cost control. A frontier model when the task is high risk or the ambiguity is expensive. The enterprise buyer will ask for a price. The builder should answer with a routing plan because a single blended average hides too much.
And the plan needs evidence from misses. Show me the task classes where the cheap model fails. Show me the tasks where the expensive model doesn't earn its fee. Show me the human review cost. That is the antidote to both forms of wishful thinking. The vendor saying the model pays for itself everywhere, and the finance team saying the cheapest green checkmark is good enough everywhere. Neither claim survives contact with a decent trace log.
Reuters reported that Norway imposed a near ban on AI in elementary school, and the Hacker News discussion around it was large enough to show how charged the education question has become. The policy fact is concrete. Younger students are being treated differently from older students and adults. Ethan Mollick's Education Post adds the mechanism the policy debate needs. AI can hurt learning when it reduces mental effort. Nature's piece asks a broader version of the same concern, whether AI is eroding skills. This segment asks where assistance turns into substitution.
I like that distinction because it maps to how learning actually works. If a tool helps a child get feedback after trying, that can be valuable. If it gives the answer before the child has done the hard cognitive step, the lesson may disappear. An elementary school is a special case. Adults can decide to trade practice for speed. A 9-year-old may not know what practice they just gave away. A teacher may not see the missing effort if the submitted answer looks polished.
There is a temptation in tech circles to treat any restriction as fear. I don't think that's fair here. Norway is making a boundary decision for children at an age where the tool can mask whether the skill is forming. The stronger pro-AI version still has room to speak. You can imagine tutors that ask better questions, adapt practice, help teachers notice confusion earlier, and support students who otherwise get lost. But those systems need to preserve the student's work, not replace it with fluent output.
And that's measurable if people care enough to measure it. Did the students sketch the approach? Did they revise their own sentence? Did they solve the arithmetic step? Did they explain why the answer changed? A school AI product should probably be judged less by the polish of the final answer and more by the record of the learner's attempts. That's uncomfortable for vendors because polished output sells. But learning happens in the messy middle, and the system has to keep that middle visible to the teacher.
The parallel with enterprise tools is almost too neat, so I will keep it modest. In both places, the output can fool you. A finished analysis, a passing code change, a well-written paragraph from a child, all of those can hide whether the human or the system did the cognitive work that creates skill. For adults at work, that's a productivity and accountability problem. For children, it becomes a developmental problem. Norway's restriction is one country's answer, but the design question travels. What evidence proves the person is still learning?
That question is going to follow AI tutors for a long time. The best versions will probably look less like answer machines and more like practice environments. They will slow the student down at the exact moment the student wants to skip ahead. That's a harder product to sell than instant homework help, but it's a better educational tool. If the child never has to hold the problem in their head, the model didn't assist the learning process. It walked around it.
The security cluster is smaller today, but it belongs near the end because it touches the same operating surface as Codex Handoff. A HelpNet security article says researchers analyzed recovered agent sessions where a low-skilled attacker used Claude Code and Codex in offensive operations. I haven't verified the underlying researcher material, so I'm being cautious about the strongest version of that claim. I am treating it as the article's report, not as independently verified fact. Mitchell Hashimoto's companion item is easier to use as a practical warning. Prompt injection can live in repo instructions and comments, not only in a user prompt.
Tusk, that is the security issue every coding agent team has to stare at. Agents read files, they read comments, they read markdown, they read instructions written by people who may not share the operator's intent. Once the agent has tools, text becomes a control surface. Enough ordinary text can influence the run that you have to decide what the agent is allowed to treat as instruction. An agent's MD file is useful because it gives the agent local norms. It is risky for the same reason.
The agent memory research items sharpen this, although I would keep them brief today. DAIRAI's AtomMem item argues for smaller memory units to avoid drift and corruption. The 2-minute papers item discusses agents passing latent state rather than text. Furbin's post points at retrieval and decision time as the next blocker. Those are research signals, not production advice yet, but they all point at an engineering object we used to hand wave. What passes between agent steps? It might be text, memory units, retrieved snippets, hidden representations, tool logs, or handoff state. All of it can influence the next action.
And influence needs provenance. If the agent tells me, I decided to delete this file because the project instructions said so, I need to know which instruction from which commit written by whom and whether that source was allowed to direct destructive action. That sounds heavy until something goes wrong. Then it sounds like the minimum record you wish you had. The prompt injection examples are annoying precisely because they turn ordinary project text into a permissions problem.
So Friday's episode starts with a person moving labs and ends with state moving through agents. Those are different stories, but the shared pressure is transfer. Can a method survive when a researcher leaves? Can a coding session survive when it moves hosts? Can a company root intelligence without losing quality? Can a school use assistance without losing practice? Can an agent carry memory without carrying untrusted instructions? The sources don't make the answer tidy. Each case has its own proof. But the weak keeps asking whether the valuable part is actually preserved when the visible artifact moves.
And the test is usually downstream. DeepMind's test is the next scientific system. Anthropic's test is whether Jumper's expertise turns into an artifact, not just a hiring headline. Codex's test is whether handoff includes the state and permissions that make the session auditable. Schools have to test whether students still do the mental work. For agents, the test is whether the system can explain why it trusted a piece of context before it acted on it. The next set of operator mistakes will show up there first.